Blog Talk Radio.
There's some dangerous large carnivore out there.
And I saw that bird kick a young deer off the road and fly away.
And it was just about getting dark, and we started panicking, running down the ridge, not really having any clue what was throwing rocks in our vicinity, good-sized rocks. And I stopped long enough to get a 357 out of my backpack and look back, and that's when I thought I saw one.
For a week, the town of Defiance was being harassed by a werewolf. And it's actually attacked two railroad workers, killed livestock. You know, just a lot of weird stuff that was going on.
And it is Sunday, January, I'm stepping back in time, it is Sunday, April 19th, 2015, and this is your host, Gunnar Monson. I have just left the Hop Squatch meeting in Portland, Oregon, hosted every month by our good friend, Guy Edwards. Guy was able to get a special guest. He's been after him for a while to come and do a program at Hopsquatch, and he really doesn't do a lot of public speaking about it anymore. Larry Lund, and Larry was very interesting to listen to. He's been around for a long time. Was involved in, you know, Bigfooting and knew all the quote unquote four horsemen. Was friends with all of them. Bigfoot with all of them. So he had a lot of interesting stories about Bigfoot history and stuff. So I am actually sitting in my Jeep today in downtown Portland. So excuse me if you hear some traffic noise. I might have a car go by or something. So it is beautiful in Portland today. I just checked the temp. It's about 74 degrees. So not bad, but it's about 117 in my Jeep. So, and with me, as always, is my good friend and fellow Bigfoot researcher, Shane Forson. Shane, how are you today?
I'm here. I'm a little under the weather. I got a little bit of a cough and whatnot, and so not 100%, but still doing well. I have been indeed enjoying this beautiful, rare Portland weather, Oregon weather. So other than a little bit of a cough and some sniffles, I'm doing A-okay.
That's good. Well, I appreciate that you showed up today. So in spite of your infirmary. and we missed you at Hopsquatch. Plenty of people ask me, where's Shane? I'm like, you know, he's has a life outside of Bigfoot, believe it or not. So
yeah,
no. We were out this weekend.
Yeah.
So we,
well,
I mean,
let me just touch upon it. I'm super bummed I didn't make it. I really, really wanted to attend this event and speak with Larry. Unfortunately, you know, I was a little bit ill. I didn't feel like I should be mixing up with other people. I got some yard work done. I'm the type of guy, when I'm sick, I sweat it out. I like to sweat it out.
Well,
it just seems to go by quicker. But super bummed I missed this event. But I did make it out this weekend along with our good friend Larry and yourself, Gunner.
Yeah, and we had Tanya with us. We drugged them out to our usual research area. So, and we had some interesting things happen. Sitting in a camp Friday night, about quarter to ten, and all of a sudden there was a howl, a long drawn out single howl from west to where we were sitting, and like we all looked at each other and thought, that was not a coyote. So that was pretty cool. We got it on about, I think Larry's up to about 15 recorders now. So
he's a madman.
We definitely Larry and I listened to it the next morning, and it definitely was interesting. And there was a lot of other interesting audio stuff that was on that recording. I sat next to Larry at Hopsquatch, and he was telling me that there's some whistles on there, which we've had, you and Larry were the first ones to experience that up there in our area. So, and I've heard whistles a couple times since. So that was pretty cool.
It's very cool. Yeah. I mean, it was really cool because we all heard that howl scream thing in person. And we all kind of looked at each other, and it's just a little bit different, or at least it didn't sound like a coyote, or it didn't sound human. It was interesting, and it was really neat because we had just got done setting up all the audio out there, and so I knew that it may not have been picked up perfectly on the audio because of some of the directions we were facing them. But I knew that it would be picked up by the audio, and then we could look at that on a spectrograph later. I was really stoked about that. And then there was some other interesting things heard that evening, and also recorded. The whistles, they're unique. I've heard them in the type of whistle. I've heard them in two different locations now, with the closest one being with Larry out there at camp. Pardon me, and. They're just unique, and I fully believe not a bird. Just doesn't sound like any bird I've ever heard that type of whistle. But and then with your dog's reaction at that time, we actually heard him in Tillamook, was pretty profound.
Yeah, and that first time, Larry's dog. It's interesting to see different dogs react different ways, because Larry's dog Cody ran at whatever whistled both times that. When you guys were there, and then a few weeks ago, I didn't on a trip I didn't make. You guys had an audio event, and Logan like got his hackles up, tucked his tail, and ran back to camp, and then whined the whole night, rest of the night. And he's been out there, on several occasions. He was out there this weekend, and happy go lucky.
He never, there was no sign of any distress or anything like that. It was odd. Those two different events.
Right. And the way that different dogs react, Cody is definitely an alpha male dog. So, he charged in head first and had to be called back that time when you guys were up there. So, and then after that, I mean, there's the whistling is interesting to me, and I've heard one firsthand right out in front of me within 50 yards in the dark. But obviously you can't see what it is, but it sure got my attention. And what was interesting on that, because we had different recorders set up that we could tell, we could kind of triangulate where it was behind one recorder, and it was in front of another recorder, which put it right where I thought it was, right out in front of me. And then when I listened to one of the recordings later, there actually was a howl that came shortly after that whistle. Of course, I didn't hear it because I immediately walked back into camp and like, do you guys whistle? kind of like I knew that wasn't that. It wasn't any you. You had heard it and thought it, and that's
yeah.
funny because you attribute it to, I think Larry was whistling or guest whistling for their dog, but and that
yeah,
wasn't them.
Indeed.
And I knew it wasn't anybody in camp. It was just funny that that was my reaction was to go back and like, wasn't it you guys, was it?
Yeah.
So.
Well, that was, yeah, that was very much my reaction. I just assumed it was Larry. And I don't know why
right.
at the time I did that. Just, you know, we just didn't expect something like that. Same, you know, when at 11:38 at night when Larry and
mm-hmm.
I were sitting at the camp, you know, and he had his dog next to us, we didn't expect to hear a whistle that close. Well, two whistles that close. You know, and have the dog react the way it did. It was just so alarming and weird. You know, it was very odd. And so, yeah, you just don't expect stuff like that. You know, it's those things that you just don't expect. You know, a lot of times you're out there doing your thing and you're listening for howls and looking for, you know, evidence. When you just, the whistles, and so you just don't really expect it to happen. When it does, it kind of catches you off guard, especially in the manner that, say, like, you know, Larry's dog reacted. It threw me for a loop because I was like, oh, man, that was close, and your dog is going after it. Not like a bird. Like it was summoned, you know, and comes back. You hear another whistle to the left, and the dog reacts the same. Never seen a dog react like that. I mean, we're around birds and all that sort of stuff, and the crisp, clear night, no sounds, no birds, and these whistles come out of nowhere, and the dog reacts the way it did. It was just strange, very odd.
And on a couple of occasions that we've been out there with Tanya's dog, Logan, we were
mm-hmm.
going up a trail out of camp this time, and he alerted and ran off the trail after, and it was deer, and then we all saw the deer take off. So we know that, you know, the noise that we can probably eliminate just by the dog's reaction, deer as being the source of the sound that you guys heard up there that weekend. So are you actually, you missed it because you were rustling around in the brush where you usually spend a good deal of your time putting up trail cams and
yeah, I just noticed the dog's reaction. I completely missed the sound, the
yeah,
bark.
Yeah.
But I just,
yeah, cause he was
I'm looking
right
behind
there
him.
With you.
Yeah. He was,
yeah,
he was about 10 feet behind me, 10
yeah.
feet behind me doing his thing. And I noticed that he just cowered, his tail tucked in, and he just looked very upset, and he just started acting real fidgety, and he took off running. I was like, well, that's weird. At the time, I didn't hear anything, so I thought, what the hell is going on? And then get back to camp and hear that there was this bark, and I missed it.
I know, but you were there in the OP, not this weekend, but the weekend before when there was a bunch of activity, and you know, you recorded something really cool, and you played it on the show last week. And I didn't really, I wasn't really able to pick it up that well, but you played, I was able to hear it at camp and watch it on the spectrograph. And,
yeah.
And it sounds so much like what, David Ellis played for us last week. There we played, he had an example, a clip that was actually known to be, a gorilla slapping its chest and then,
mm-hmm.
played a recording that he'd gotten. I believe it was up in Washington. And then yours was up in the Olympic Peninsula, and yours, very fascinating that it sounds so much like the gorilla chest slap. And you were there, but you didn't hear, you actually didn't hear that when it was recorded. In fact, you were talking about how quiet the night had been. So.
Yeah, indeed. Oh, yeah, you know, I had camped out there kind of remote, a little bit different than what some of the things we usually do out there in Olympics, and had placed the recorder, 40 yards away from camp, basically, on a stump. I'd covered it up, like my usual MO, and it was just a really quiet evening, but the reason I was camping out there because there was a possible sighting.
Mm-hmm.
There was definitely something running around up there, possible sign by another Olympic member, and it was, the whole thing was fascinating due to who actually saw it and the following evidence, the tracks they had found, impressions and whatnot. So I decided I want to go up there and camp, and Tanya accompanied me, and she had her dog Logan with her, and we were camping out there. We placed recorders around, and it was really quiet evening, really quiet, never heard anything. And then you know, the following morning, you know, listened to a few tidbits. It wasn't until I got home and really reviewed my audio that I found that. And this thing was fairly close to my recorder. And not all. So when you look at a spectrograph, you don't always get everything on the spectrograph. You can't always. It doesn't always register on there. So I had heard huffs and some movement on this in the nearby area, and it kind of piqued my interest. And then I heard, you know, some more huffs, and then I heard this just slap on it. I was like, wow. It peaked up pretty high on the spectrograph. And so I sent it off to Larry, and Larry, well, actually I met up with Larry, and we listened to it, and we were both very interested. And we chopped it up, you know, cut a slice of it, the real interesting part of the audio, and sent it to David Ellison. He had corroborating recordings of stuff he's recorded three times now. And then we compared that, or David Ellis compared it to, you know, a gorilla sighting his chest. And it was just eerily similar. Even though the gorilla was a lot closer to the mic, it peaked a lot higher, it was eerily similar. And so just, you know, it's just another thing to add to the database and whatnot. Really happy that we got that piece of audio. There's other stuff on that audio. I got another really nice howl and a couple of real clear sounding wood knocks, you know, that we never heard, which is, you know, it's amazing. Usually, I'm such a light sleeper, I'm surprised I never heard that stuff. But after hiking, I don't know how many miles in the last 2 days, I was pretty beat. So anyways, but, you know, it's interesting that chest slap, because it has been recorded over, and there's only so many things something of that nature could be. And the fact to see it on a spectrograph and look at it and compare it to a known gorilla chest slap, it's really cool stuff, I think.
And then using a spectrograph to analyze audio, I mean, gives you a whole nother level of comparison, because you can look for anomalies and then you compare signatures. Because just listening to something, you know, what did I say when I heard it? I thought, oh, was that a beaver tail slap? You know, well, obviously,
exactly.
Every piece of evidence requires context, and and given all the and audio more probably than anything else, you hear something, you need to know what the context of what it was, what you heard, and having so many different pieces of corroborating evidence in that OP recording in the chest slap, and before that, there was, you know, a possible something described as definitely bipedal, you know,
at
crossing
time, yeah.
The trail, right, and then at times, and then there was actually a photograph taken, fuzzy, and you're trying to, the witness up there actually chased it, pursued.
Oh, yeah,
and,
well,
and
it's then James Million. The guy's he's an awesome, very fit, very brave, long life hunter, survivalist, and he's one of those guys that, you know, he's got to see it. You know, so he chased after it, and it took off, and it stopped at some points, and he even did a scream at it. He screamed at this thing, and he got fairly close, but it was the soul owl and stuff was so high, it was hard to see. Went up a hill, and he lost it, just way too fast for him. But they did measure the stride length on the impressions they found, and they were 50 inches, and it had snapped a good 4-inch limb on the ground, smashed it.
honestly, I mean, I watched our friend Cindy posted a video of a bear, a three-legged bear, that in the video, and I'd seen it before. But for comparison, just the gait of a bear doesn't look anything like what reported Bigfoot gait sounds like, and it's a very short gait. So you can get, you know, on occasion in the right conditions, you can get a double strike, but you're not going to get a double strike with a bear walking on 2 feet. So that print would look would not look like a Bigfoot. It'd be very, you know, truncated, triangle ankle, you know, triangle heel, and with claw. You know, a lot of times we'll see claw marks, but you're not.
Yeah,
get
it was funny to
stride from a bear on 2 feet.
Right.
So
yes, exactly. unless you missed a track in between or impression in between, which where they had found these impressions, there was. Pretty evident, nothing had stepped in, but as far as we could tell, I did in that day actually hiking around, find an impression myself in a different area, but not too far away. Before I had heard of this encounter, I was pretty stoked because I was like, "Oh man, this is a really neat looking impression." And you know, Derek had texted me, said, "Hey, James had a possible sighting of something. And to James' credit, he's not come out screaming Bigfoot or anything like that. Like I said before, he's not ruling out bear. He just found it very interesting in its behavior and some of the direction it took. You know, there were certain things that were interesting to him being a lifelong hunter that he couldn't necessarily explain, including the impressions. You know, and David Ellis was there to, you know, get some corroborating evidence and stuff. So inconclusive, of course, but still interesting. And the area that this encountered, we've had a lot. This happened. We've had a lot of stuff happen over the years, and we've really got a core area now that we're really keep focusing on.
And I talked a little bit to Derek Randall's about that, and he said, you know, this is a time of year in which the Olympic Frontic is all about predictability and establishing patterns and trying to figure out what these, if these things exist. And as David said, we're actually trying to prove they don't exist by eliminating all the evidence that comes through and say that, you know, and then you're left, if you do that and you're left with a lot of it, and there is a lot of a preponderance of evidence that can't be explained away by any known animal. So again, exclusion, you know, and he was saying that April, May is a time of high activity in that area of the Olympics. And it is an area that other stuff has happened. And again, that's, I always, you know, there's, to me, an anecdotal story, I saw something cross the road. Very, you know, interesting. It's fun to hear about, but I crossed the road and I found, and I chased it and I saw it visually. You know, I took a fuzzy photo and I found tracks and I found a branch, you know, a lot of corroborating evidence. I think that's, now you got something that is in an area where you've had other activity. In fact, there was a thermal of a couple of individual entities, for lack of a better word, bipedal, that you witnessed. You were there when that thermal was taken and found it very compelling. Besides the activity of the subjects in the therm. And that was a stone throw away from where this activity took place. So it all builds.
Literally,
literally.
And, you know, Derek and I, with that FLIR footage we had taken, that evening, you know, it was an area that we've been working in for a while now, and had some interesting stuff happen, including a trip out there with Adam Davies, very interesting stuff happened then. And we were actually call blasting, David Ellis was call blasting that night, some particular sounds, and, it was something we hadn't really tried a whole lot, therming wise, someone's call blasting from two different areas, and the subject, large, heat signature appeared, and then a second individual, a lot smaller than the first individual, appeared, and it looks like at times like it, the larger individual puts its arm or something up on the tree, and then the smaller individual, which looks rather bipedal, takes off. Now, we've said the whole time we're not saying that 100% it's a Sasquatch or name. It could be. We're not ruling out elk. There is a population of elk there. It's about 40 individual stick that does inhabit this area. It was just odd under the call blasting scenario and for them to appear the way they did. And for, you know, we did a recreation and with a guy, and he was, you know, he's about 6'2", 6'3". He's a big guy. And he measured up to the smaller individual, but was the larger individual was almost double the size of this guy. So, it's interesting. What's that?
Say what? So you talk. Yeah. I mean, you're talking in like in a 12-foot range. Quite a double is.
Just, well, double definitely width and height
width.
A couple
okay,
feet.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, just broad. So you can't. You know, it's indefinitive. It's just it's interesting. Based on the area and that stuff, you know, so definitive, no, not definitive.
Well, we'd be having a different conversation if it was definitive, so.
Exactly. But, I mean, you know, it's another thing we add to our database, and it's an area that
right.
We just keep focusing in on, you know, and like you mentioned before, Gunner, we're about patterns, and think we've really keyed in on an area that's just with high amount of activity and some weird stuff happening and possible sightings, impressions found, lots of audio recorded, and it seems that this time of year we get a lot of interesting things happen, you know. And I believe with the Tillamook group that we work with, we get the same sort of stuff, and we're still gathering data. And I don't know if we've nailed down really good times of year. I think we have a couple, you know, but predominantly we get a lot of audio throughout the year. So it's hard. It's just, you know, it's just interesting stuff.
Well, it's a real, and our area in the Tillamook forest is pretty temperate. I mean, we didn't even have, I don't know that we had any snow up in that elevation this year. It didn't last long, which is pretty unusual. So, it's, you know, what drives an animal if they exist, and you already know they do. Not that I'm calling you a nobody.
Oh, yeah.
I just know that you've had a visual encounter. So, they, you know, what drives them to, and I don't think they migrate. There's a lot of conversation, do they migrate, you know, don't they migrate? They seem to follow the food source and move up and down, but I've been involved in this Tillamook area now for going a good year and a half, and we've had activity that we couldn't explain as any other known animal almost year round. There's been a few times we've been skunked, you know, and I never go up there expecting anything to happen. I was just like this weekend, I was surprised when we had, you know, had a howl at, like I said, about 9:45, and just caught us all off guard. And one of the things that I found fascinating is you had decided to remote camp west of our base camp, and that's the direction that the howl came from. And I always wondered, when we change our behaviors in an area, how does that affect, you know, other, if they exist, if that's what we're recording and we're hearing, how does it, you know, affect these animals? So,
yeah.
And I just thought, because a lot of times what we've had audio, and we did have some other howls and stuff from the opposite location, basically from the kind of a southeasterly area from the camp, so not directly across, but that sounded different. It would have been a different individual. I don't think it would have been the same animal running across, you know, several miles of forest in the pitch black. And it's interesting when we do stuff. And you've been talking about doing remote camping, and just like you did at the OP, going away from, you know, I think there's some validity to what the hypothesis that if we go out into and remote camp in an area where we know there's activity, that you draw interest, you know, their curiosity of what the hell are they up to, that they're out in my, you know, my area. And I still think the experience that Larry and I had up there, Larry likes to call it the Jurassic Park night, and it's a night of, like, bumping. I didn't feel the vibration of the ground like it was a T-Rex, but definitely a weird sound. But we were doing something that we didn't normally do, and that's go out of east out of camp. And Larry has a well-developed hunter's sense of stuff, and his sense was get the hell out of the area. Where my naivete is like, what the hell is that? What's making that noise? Larry damn near had to pull me down the trail. I was like, dude, this is not a good sign. We're being told to get the hell out of here. I'm like, yeah, but what is it? what makes a bumping sound that follows you? And I'm like, we gotta go. So
yeah.
Thanks again, Larry, for saving my life that night. So.
Yeah. Well, guy on the line, do you want to bring him in on now?
We could make him wait a little. No, I'm just totally kidding. Yeah, let's bring guy on.
Yeah.
We want to get to this this was a good, another good program. Guy just does a phenomenal job. So
exactly.
I hope he didn't
I'm
hear
very
that.
Sad I missed it, but can't wait to hear more about it. Guy Edwards, are you there?
Yes, yes. Make me wait a little bit, I see. Well played. I'll get you back.
well played. Guy Edwards.
Sorry, Mr. Shane. It was a great event. Larry Lund was very candid. And for those in your audience that are not familiar with Larry Lund, he is, my nickname for him is the fifth horseman or the fifth pillar of Sasquatch research.
I thought he was the fifth beetle.
Right, the fifth beetle, yes. Yes. The other drummer before Ringo, right?
No, it was a great, another, go ahead.
So for those that don't know, I actually worked, been working on this for about 2 years, and that's not an exaggeration. I was fortunate enough to be invited to these breakfasts that Larry Lund and Joe Bilard and kind of these like second tier or second generation Bigfooters that have all probably kind of rubbed elbows with the original Sasquatch researchers. And they often get together out in Gresham at a breakfast place called Heidi's. It's a German breakfast restaurant. And so it took me about a year before I felt comfortable enough to ask him. And it was a little bit hairy getting him nailed down to which month to do it. But what I find refreshing about Larry Lund is he's extremely candid. He really feels comfortable kind of calling it as he sees it. He's a very nice guy. He doesn't talk trash about anybody. But he just has such a unique perspective. That, another way to put it is he's the guy that you want to be hanging around the campfire with all night long and just have him just, you know, spew the different stories he had with from people from, you know, Peter Byrne to Rene de Hinden to John Green and Grover Krantz. And he just, you know, he actually did research with all these guys. So it was all amazing. He did not disappoint. He shared a lot of great stories tonight, so it was great.
Well, I enjoyed it thoroughly. I mean, I got a chance to go up and chat with him a little bit, and very down to earth guy. You know, he was one of those guys that like when you know kind of like Dr. Meldrum is now, or say Cliff, or Moneymaker, that when they wanted somebody for TV about Bigfoot, Larry was one of those guys.
Right.
I found out that there was a false rumor I might have participated in spreading that on our promotion of this episode of Monster X, as I was under the impression that he had been on The Tonight Show, and he assured us that he most certainly had not been on The Tonight Show.
Well, I thought that was the case because there's that famous photo of him and Jay Leno. Like, you can, if you Google Larry Lund, you'll actually see, the person you'll see in Google is that photo of him and Jay Leno. But I guess he never quite made it to the show, even though they met and became great friends, it sounds like.
Yeah, and he actually had been to Jay's house and got to look at his, you know, well-known that he's a car aficionado, and Larry went to his place. And that, you know, that kind of stuff is fun. It's obviously, it's not doing a whole lot for the Bigfoot research, but his connection to the Four Horsemen. I mean, he definitely is one of those guys that was involved in all that, you know, in the Patterson-Gimlin footage and good friends. And he's still good friends with the surviving horsemen. You know, Peter and John are still around with us, but, you know, we've lost Dr. Krantz and we lost Rene to Hinden. And he is a great storyteller and shared a lot of stuff of, you know, apparently there was a little animosity between some of them at different times, and that's not different than, you know, today. Different Bigfoot researchers will be at odds. And I think, of course, it's worse with Facebook and social media because it becomes, you know, all misunderstandings are magnified one bazillion times by Facebook and social media. So. It was funny because he was telling, well, how did you, there was somebody asking him, how did you get a hold of these guys? I think it was a question that you asked him, Guy.
Right, I was actually going to pick up on that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, I mean, his response, like, you know, there was a thing where you wrote on a piece of paper, and then you folded it, and you stuck in an envelope with a stamp. I mean, and some of that is actually, I think, it didn't stop them from not, you know, from having disagreements, but it does definitely slow down the process of and then, you know, telephone, they would send them your telephone number, and pretty, I mean,
right, yeah, because, you know, back then when you would call long distance, they would charge you an arm and a leg back in the day, right?
Right.
And so he said, and actually, you know, to save money, they would just do letters as well, because if you got on the phone with one of these guys, you know, you would want to talk to them for hours. You didn't, you know, charge by the minute back in the day. The other part that I think is great is that he's an archivist. So there he has tons of filing cabinets of letters that these guys would send back and forth to each other. And he actually has, you know, a copy of almost a lot of the letters that these guys would write to each other as well in his home. So I've not got a chance to see those. I'm probably going to go see him sometime before the end of the year. But I've seen during these breakfasts, he's actually brought a couple of these letters where these guys have actually mailed a letter to each other, and he's made a copy. So he's a great archivist. He basically has a museum that in his basement where he used to let almost anybody and everybody come in, but he's a little bit more restrictive now. But that's how Cliff Berkman from Finding Bigfoot initially got to meet him, is he heard that this Larry Lund guy, otherwise known as the Sasquatch Sleuth, had a whole archive of the original Bigfooters and the kind of questions and the responses that they would have to each other. So I can't wait to kind of like...
And Larry made kind of a big statement, is that he basically took credit for Cliff Berkman becoming a Bigfooter.
Yes, because this is back... Yeah, he definitely took credit for that. You know, Cliff is known for being a Bigfoot nerd, but more specifically, I think, you know, when you get to know Cliff a little bit better, you realize that he's a real cast nerd, and he's actually been able to bring some kind of insights to even Dr. Meldrum's collection of what these prints are, and you know, definitely everybody knows that Dr. Meldrum is a cast nerd himself, and he thinks about the different forms of all the different casts and stuff like that, the anatomy and the locomotion and stuff like that. But Cliff was able to look at Dr. Meldrum's collection and provide some insights. And I think that I would say that, you know, Cliff not only has a bigger collection than Dr. Meldrum, but also he is, I think, if you were to give an award to someone, the official nerdiest of the nerds for Bigfoot casts. And Larry Lund said today that the first cast that that Cliff ever got was actually from Larry Lund's collection.
It's, you know, what's interesting is one of the first things when I, right after, not too long after Al Gore invented the internet, and one of the first things I looked up was Bigfoot, and I got on this chat list. This was, you know, eons before Facebook, I think. Mark Zuckerberg was still, he might have still been, this might have been before he was bought a twinkle in his dad's eye. But I was on this chat list, and Matt Moneymaker was on it. It was hosted by Henry Franzoni. And I didn't know who any of these people were at the time, and it was before there was any, and with all due respect to the people on the show, Larry likes to refer it to as not finding Bigfoot. So, which, honestly, they haven't found Bigfoot yet, so, or conclusive proof of Bigfoot. And Larry was one of the people who was on that chat list. And I asked him,
Wow.
I thought I knew him from that list, and we just all bullshitted about Bigfoot, and, you know, some of us became podcast hosts. Some of us went on to be, you know, TV personalities, and some of us were close associates of the Four Horsemen.
Right.
So, and it was cool. It's just the stories were, you know, and I think there's a lot of value in the history of how we got to where we are. I mean, if we don't have that and build on past experience and we're just starting over every generation, and Larry is as the fifth horseman, really, you know, is an archivist, is adding a huge value to Bigfooting. But then again, that could be lost if someone like you, Guy, didn't go and drag him to an event where our generation of Bigfooters has an opportunity to be exposed to those stories and the person. So, I applaud you for literally working on this for a couple of years to get him to, because he doesn't go out and do a lot of public speaking.
Thank you. I appreciate the kind words. I think that's one of the things that he acknowledged is I think the last time was maybe 2010 or 2011 when he did an event in Stevenson, Washington, and that was the last time that he actually did any type of a speaking engagement. And as a lot of people got a chance to notice today, is super nice guy, calls it as he sees it, and I think he was, in a lot of ways, you know, the unsung hero or the glue for the original Four Horsemen.
I was just thinking that, yeah. Because he always seemed to be in the good graces of all of them. You know, they might be fighting,
exactly,
but...
Absolutely. Right. And I think that, you know, even although they might have had their differences at any point in time, what we're able to also kind of understand is he was in their good graces. He had their respect and their appreciation. And I think, if you listen real closely to some of the stories, he was kind of the in-between guys when they didn't want to talk to each other, but they wanted to talk to each other. You know, he was the guy that was the go-between. And I think it's a credit to his personality. I mean, he's you know what you're going to get. There's no duplicity in his what he's trying to say or how he's trying to present himself. But also, he just he gives out a lot of respect, and I think, you know, when someone is that nice and that respectful, I think you can't help, you know, kind of return the favor. So,
his nickname.
I'd liken him to in our generation is that a guy like Shane Corson. Everybody likes Shane, and everybody shares a story.
Yeah.
For Shane. And I mean, no, I mean, it's hard to, no,
no
you
no,
get
you,
along. I mean,
I'm,
you know, the funny thing is, you know, everybody, I can't like say a name of a Bigfooter that you like, can't talk, you know, you know who they are. And it's funny is that Larry and I talked about, like, you retain information like a safe. It's like, it's crazy. It's like, how does he know all this shit? And they're like,
there's people like
Bigfoot. It's crazy.
Well,
yeah, I
kind of
jump on his
bandwagon
too. I agree with Shane. What I love about Shane is he. I think everybody knows right away when they meet him is he's very serious about this, and I think that's
mm-hmm.
important. I think, you don't need to talk to him for more than 2 minutes to realize this guy's the real deal. He's very serious about this, and I think that. Kind of seriousness, you know, is kind of a relief because he's in it for the actual phenomenon and the research, where I think a lot of people, you can tell right away that they're kind of into Bigfoot because they want to be the guy to find Bigfoot, whereas Shane is, I'm sure you'd like to be the guy, but Shane is just all serious about the research itself and is willing to, you know, basically be a sponge and grab any piece of information. And he's well respecting the community, that's for sure.
No, and that really important, I mean, is that one of the differences, I think, in this generation is there are some people, and our group is one of those groups that is willing, you know, well, our goal is to prove the existence of this unknown animal, this fascinating, you know, solve this mystery. But I think we also have a realization that we can get there faster working together with other groups of people, you know, sharing information, There's an incredible amount of crossover between our Tillamook group and Valuable. We have other friends that we share information with, and Shane is a big part of that. Larry's really good at networking with. I still remember getting up at Bigfoot and crawling out of my tent, and Larry's holding court with John Bindernagel and Ron Moorhead and everybody. And Larry doesn't know who any of these guys are. I mean, Larry came into Bigfooting through an experience that his daughter had, and then he went out and pursued it, and that was the birth of the Tillamook Forest Research Group. Was Larry, most of the times those stories would be, all you would have is an anecdotal story, and somebody went up and investigated, and then it gets filed, and that's really nice. But Larry kept going up there, and then his friend Mark became obsessive about it to a degree that he was going to, keep going, and he kept stuff happening, and then Cindy got involved, and then I got involved, and then we, Shane came on board, and Jess and Tanya and Barb. Hope I didn't miss anybody, because I'll get a nasty Facebook post about it later, but was totally inadvertent if I did. But the value, and then what you do with Hopsquatch every month. You talk a lot about the wet Oregon, the West Coast group being behind in, versus what happens on the East Coast, when really the largest amount of evidence seems to come from this area, and you are you're the glue that kind of binds our community over here together, and I think we're catching up.
I think so. I appreciate that too, because I think I probably echo that every Hopsquatch, but it was really nice for Larry Lund to kind of chime right in right after I said that and said, yeah, Bigfoot is a Pacific Northwest phenomenon for sure, and it's almost odd that some of these other communities, from Ohio to everywhere else, where Texas, where they actually have a community that's more organized. When I think that Bigfoot can be everywhere and anywhere, but to me, I think Bigfoot is definitely a Pacific Northwest phenomenon, which includes Northern California.
Bigfoot is ours, damn it.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's not a Hopsquatch that doesn't go by where I feel or I hear feedback from people who have connected to Hopsquatch and kind of built this bigger community. So I don't think that my work is done by any means. I think there's still more connections to be had, but I love the idea of, and the short way to say it is I want other Bigfooters in other parts of the country to be jealous of Portland. I want them to wish they lived out here so they could connect with the community out here.
Well, the thing is I think it's already happening. I can see it because Ohio this month is having, or next month, no, starting this month, this weekend, is having three separate Bigfoot conferences in the same location, one after the other. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I was reading a post on Facebook about that today. Like, why can't we just have one? So that shows a little bit of a fracture in the community back there. But, if you got three conferences full of participants, then God bless you. But I found Hopsquatch is like a home for Bigfoot. We're kind of weirdos anyway, because it's funny to me when we Bigfooters are fighting and my Bigfooting's better than your Bigfooting, because it's bullshit, because we don't have the answer yet. So we're far better off connecting and sharing information. We're not all going to look. I mean, that's one of the cool things about Hopsquatch is there's people of every, for lack of a better term, discipline, and belief system. And I've yet to see anybody throw down yet. So,
from Tom Powell, who is part paranormal, to other people let me backtrack a little bit. So there's huge debates, kill, no kill, whether Bigfoot's an animal or a person, you know, all these, whether it's paranormal, biological, you know, these all these big debates, I believe, are debates worth having as long as you're not too close to it. But I also believe that a lot of these debates are putting the cart before the horse, right? So,
right.
So I mean, we can all, you know, kind of guess what Bigfoot is, but, you know, until we actually have that specimen, whatever, however way we find it, until we meet Bigfoot, you know, it's all speculation. And I think that's one of the things that that most of the people in the Northwest do as well, is they realize that they don't have a monopoly on it, but they are kind of loud and proud about what they're interested in, you know. Tom is very interested in, maybe there might be some kind of a, Tom Powell might be interested in maybe some type of alien influence or something, you know. And I think that's,
well,
good.
That's just crazy.
We need, yeah, right. So, but I think, you know, to have what I would consider, you know, specialists inside the Bigfoot phenomena is healthy, you know, because we're not echoing each other. We're not, you know, duplicating the research. But I can safely say that, and when I look across the audience of everybody that shows up at Hopsquatch, I know that that we have such a diversity in views of Bigfoot, and yet everybody is kind of hungry and interested in hearing each other. I think that's what is most one of the things that's important to the Hopsquatch audience is they want to listen. They want to hear someone's different perspective.
Well, and the value in having civil debate without, you know, which doesn't seem to be what that, you know, that Facebook is not a great forum for civil debate. For some reason, that's a, you know, something negative happens on there and it's multiplied over and over and over again so quickly. And, you know, things get out of hand. And I mean, it's Hopsquatch is, you don't have to agree with everybody. And you hit the nail on the head. We don't know what, you know, we're putting the cart before the horse, arguing the finer, you know, what their all the aspects of this creature are. We don't know. We can't even prove to the general public that they exist. So to argue about whether or not, you know, how they get here and if they, you know, what kind of attributes they have, different aspects. Toby Johnson is putting up a video about, seeing lights in the sky in association with Bigfoot activity.
Right.
But that's been it's a fascinating video to watch. You know, he interviews Ron Moorhead on there, Shannon LeGros on there, people that I have an interest in and have respect for the time that they spend in Bigfooting. And I don't know, that's not been my experience, but I'm not going to, listen, when it comes down to it, I look for Bigfoot, which people, the layman, makes me a little nuts already. So for me to point fingers at other people that say they, you know, that they do this or they have this attribute, you know, and I've unfriended people on Facebook where I think, you know, where it becomes personal and the blow up, you know, the blow up on Sasquatch Chronicles was
Gunner, and I apologize, and I want to be refriended if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, yeah. well, I'm, the only reason that you're only friended guy is because there's no love, buddy. So
I don't know how much time we have, but I do want to talk about the possibility of you and Shane kind of helping me out with the Hopsquatch and Gene. Have we talked to Shane about that yet, or is that public yet?
Shane will be fine. He'll be there. I mean, we've talked offline about that, and actually I think Shane was pushing for a town hall. Yeah, like, I mean, witness encounters. Yeah, so we need to talk about the date and run the date by Shane, because I don't know what Shane's calendar looks like. The guy's the busiest guy in Bigfooting, so... We talked today a little bit about doing it in June. So,
yeah, third Sunday in June, and I would definitely, you know, promote it if that date works out. You know, I'd promote the heck out of it so we could get these Bigfoot witnesses to talk about Bigfoot stuff that that we might not even know about yet, you know. And I'll put it out in the local papers, and I'll say if you've had a Bigfoot encounter, come to Hopscotch in June.
And we'll put the word
I
out
think it's
too.
Fantastic idea.
Are you clear in June, Shane? You need to get. Do you have your calendar?
I will make myself for an event like that. I would want to make it better than most of this sort of event. You know, as far as a town hall thing, I want to make it something that people can leave there going, "I learned something," or "I found something compelling." Or so, yeah, I'd definitely be there, and I would do my darndest to make it one of the better town hall meetings that have been done in the past. It'd be above the rest, in my opinion. That's how animate I'm about doing something of this nature.
Awesome, because that's right in there with the philosophy of Hopscotch, is to elevate all this stuff, you know, to take it up
exactly.
to that next notch. And I know that you'll do that, Shane.
And the word that jumps to mind is epic. I think we'll have an epic Hopscotch in June. Yes.
Yeah.
We
will talk about this and maybe have some dinner or something, talk about this and make it happen and share some ideas. I definitely really, really want to do this. I think it's a positive thing. I think it's something that's not been done yet with the Hopscotch events. I think there's a lot of value to this sort of thing, especially here in the Pacific Northwest, where there are a lot of credible people that have had encounters, and I think it could be just fantastic all around. So let's plan this. But I did want to talk about Larry a little bit more, mainly because I wasn't at this particular Hopscotch event, which I'm very saddened by, trust me. I try to make every one that I can. And to see Larry Lunt in his element talking would have been epic. Unfortunately, I didn't make it. But Larry
quickly,
is described.
Is that going to... Are you broadcasting these events now?
Yeah, so they will be broadcast. Mike Lesh, who is my videographer, has been busy, but we do have them all recorded on high definition, so they will be broadcast, and then we'll also have them on YouTube. So we've got two almost in the can. They haven't been edited, and then we'll be able to broadcast these for sure. And there was a couple of times where Larry shared some stuff that he asked us to turn off the camera, which was great for everybody who attended.
Sorry, burn.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was...
Sorry, Shane. No, that was not...
It's $5. It costs $5 to go, so you got to get, you know, something besides free Sasquatch coffee and cool Bigfoot bling.
Right. But for anybody who is within the these will be broadcast on cable access to Metro East Community Media, and they will be on YouTube after we get them edited. And so eventually, we want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to feel like they're at Hopscotch. And I'm not worried about someone deciding not to come to Hopscotch knowing that they're going to be on video, because there's really no replacement of being there and kind of rubbing elbows with everybody. And although you know, I do want to make these things accessible to everybody to a certain degree. So,
to be able to put them up there so we can thumb our noses at the people back east. If they see what we have and you don't have it. Yeah,
let them know what they're missing out on.
Damn straight. But you know, so, Larry Lunt. He's been called, you know, his nickname is the Sasquatch Sleuth, you know. Pardon?
No, go ahead. I misheard you.
Oh, okay. He's been doing this for 40-plus years. Yeah, well, guess what? But he's been doing this for 40-plus years. He describes himself as an authority but not an expert. You know, and I think that's important because there's a great distinction there between an authority on the subject rather than an expert. He does say there's no experts out there, but he does describe himself as an authority. And I look at Larry as an authority. You know, he's worked with and done his homework. He's been doing this for such a long time. I was just curious Did he go into, you know, his thoughts on if there have been any advancements, any progressive research stuff going on nowadays that he's looking forward to that have not been done in the last, say, 40 years? I mean, is there anything that he's possibly speaking to? Because he is skeptical by nature, and that speaks volumes about the guy, because he's never just latched on to anything. He's found tracks himself. He found tracks on multiple occasions. He's gone out and looked at reports and everything else. But is there anything new that he described about nowadays that he found going in the right direction? Anything like that?
No, you hit the nail right on the head, because there's two points that you just made. The Sasquatch Sleuth, we found out, was actually a name that was given him by Rene de Hinden. And so what had happened was, like, now when you get one of his business cards, it actually says a Sasquatch Sleuth. And
it is a hot spot.
Right. And he picked up that moniker and he loved it, and he kind of ran with it. The way he got it was, one day in his mail, he actually got a pack of 100 or 500 business cards that said the Sasquatch Sleuth, with his name on it and his phone number and his email address, and he didn't know where he got it from. And eventually, Rene de Hinden admitted that he was the one that got these business cards made, and so Rene de Hinden gave him that name because, although a lot of people were doing research on Sasquatch and, you know, what is this creature? What is it, you know, how hairy is he? How big is he? What is his foot length and how big is he? Larry was the guy that actually investigated the witnesses more so than anybody else. So whenever somebody had an encounter or talked about an encounter, Larry also investigated the actual story or the actual encounter itself more so than what was the creature. And so he got that nickname actually from Rene de Hinden. And we didn't talk too much about process, although a little bit we did. And he says that, you know, and I asked him what he tried, and he said he's tried everything, you know, from call blasting to playing different music to but I did get a chance to ask him where he would go investigate Bigfoot if he had all the time and the money today to do it. And Gunnar, I think he said Harrison Hot Springs in Canada, right?
He did.
So he said up in Canada would be the place that he would go to. And he kind of picked up a little bit on, and I mentioned, you know, maybe we need to, you know, instead of chase Bigfoot, go to the latest sightings, spend some time out there. And I think he kind of echoed that too, saying that if you're going to do Bigfoot research, you need to stick in the same area for a while. You know, not just one weekend, not just for 1 week, but for a whole season if you can. And he said the place that he would pick is actually in Canada. And what was that place called? It was actually called Bigfoot or Sasquatch?
Sasquatch Mountain was, or Sasquatch
Park?
Not camp. Sasquatch Park. I think it was Sasquatch Park.
Yeah.
I mean, what a better place to go.
Yeah,
but there
so
are
if I.
In that area, I guess, so. Yeah, it's
so now that everybody's listening to Monster X, we can all meet up there, you know.
Yeah, next weekend. But it's interesting because he was talking about, you know, a long term Jane Goodall kind of experience and have somebody out in the field like that. I mean, you know, with the Falcon project, I mean, that's one of the things that I find fascinating and having potential is having, you know, you got a group of people with technology going out into an area that has a history, and yes, they don't have the blimp yet. Yes, that's right. They may never have a blimp, but...
Oh, really? I didn't hear that part.
But there is a guy I know that in Oregon a while back that, you know, blew up a whole bunch of giant helium balloons and tied them to a lawn chair. So worst case scenario, you got that to fall back on. And I'd volunteer Shane to do that. But
I can't tell if you're serious right now.
No, there was a guy that flew his lawn chair full of, you know, tied hot air balloon or tied a bunch of huge helium balloons to it and then floated from Oregon to Idaho. I think that rest, I mean, it's been several years ago, but I'm not suggesting that as an alternative to the airship, the Falcon projects working on. But I mean, the idea of them being, you know, having a group of people out in the field with a lot of technology for a 6 month period of time to initially is, I think, has huge potential. I mean, and it's being financed. It, you know, sounds like the financing is coming together, and that's the best project that I'm aware of that nature at this point. I don't know anybody that's been out there for that long for. You know, and with the purpose of studying Bigfoot. So,
yeah. Well, I still think I know that FLIR has technology that's available to the public that they sell to the general consumer, but I do know that they actually have different technology that's reserved for the military that is even better than what they have available for the consumer. It's very expensive. But
mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, that would be a, I mean, I'm even going back to that Finding Bigfoot episode where they had those field mice or whatever, those small rodents that were like a mile away, that you could actually almost count the hairs on their tails, you know. So I think I'm exaggerating a little bit. But I thought there was very high definition when they had that, you know, so I would think that there's got to be somebody that can build up a relationship with FLIR that you don't even have to be in the sky. You can actually, you know, see things, you know, on ground from far away where you get such high definition Bigfoot, you know. I mean, I've been a little critical of the Falcon Project just because they've been, you know, excuse the pun, trying to get off the ground for more than 5 years. So.
Well, and that's sometimes. I mean. One of the challenges, of course, in Bigfooting is it's a hobby for most everybody, you know.
Right.
So other than a few folks that have been on TV, we pay to go out Bigfooting. We're not paid to Bigfoot. You know, there's a few people that have had some funding thrown their way, but it's not, you know, the whole – and one of those big projects was the Erickson project that came out of the BFRO. And you know, for years and years, we were led to believe that there was some really compelling evidence that was going to prove for once and for all that they exist. And it was so, you know, and what has happened? It looks like a rug, you know, a rug in the woods and some funky-looking Chewbacca mask. And I'm not suggesting that's – I mean, there could be – maybe it's a Bigfoot, but it sure looks – it's certainly didn't end the debate by any means. So, and that's a project that had some money thrown at it. The, you know, the Falcon Project, I guess I got to give it to William Barnes that he has stuck with it this long and it looks like it's coming to fruition. At least the ground portion is getting underway. So, well, no, I mean, it either will or it won't, just like everything else. You know, every time we go out in the woods, we're hopeful that we come back with the conclusive evidence. But Larry forgot the rope this week, so.
One of the – see, the reason I asked in regards to Larry Lund as far as, you know, has anything been – does he see anything new happening in the field that is a little bit different than it's been done in the last 40, 50 years, is because I, for one, do not want to continue along the path of doing the same old, and getting the same results. I am personally, and I know lots of others are constantly involved in trying to up the ante, trying to think outside the box, trying to really do their homework on the subject matter, And look at what's been done in the past, look at those that have been doing what they're doing, and build upon that. And I do see that happening. I just was curious as if Larry had any thoughts on that, and maybe that wasn't a topic he discussed tonight. But I do personally see advancements. I do see possible patterns being built and stuff like that. So that's the stuff I key on that really interests me personally.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that you did say that I thought was interesting is that, what a lot of people are doing now is doing the night hikes with the night vision and stuff like that. He is still a huge proponent of going out during the day and trying to find Bigfoot. And one of the things he said is, our best evidence that we have is Patterson-Gimlin, which was done at 1:15 in the afternoon. And so so he was pretty passionate about, about going out Bigfoot during the day. That's when not only are you going to get better footage, but there's not an overwhelming evidence that Bigfoot is nocturnal, and even though there's a lot of sightings of people almost seeing Bigfoot like at night and stuff like that, he's saying that there's no reason that Bigfoot's not out during the day, and especially since Bigfoot is hanging out, doing walks, exposed during the daytime. That's where you're going to get the best evidence if you're trying to get evidence and you're trying to,
showcase to the group. Yeah.
Photographic, but you know what? Yeah. Who's going to be finding tracks or impressions or hair at night? It's not going to happen.
Right.
It's so difficult during the day, let alone night. So, yeah, I totally agree. Good portion of the evidence has been found during the day, whether it's footage or hair or impressions or possible sightings, and that's been corroborated with both the Tillamook Group and the Alignment Project. And Derek Randles is a big proponent. He loves doing the night ops and everything else, but he's one of those guys that will get out in the field during the day because he fully believes that in looking for evidence during the day, because you can see during the day. We're not nocturnal by nature. We're out of our element when we go out at night. We're in a whole different realm, and yes, thermal footage can be compelling and interesting, but your best avenue for finding evidence and getting that visual is going to be during the day, putting yourself in these areas where, you've built patterns up or there's been sightings and stuff, and that's where you got to put yourself. And I do believe it has to be long-term. No weekend warrior stuff. Unfortunately, most of us are kind of tied down with a good portion of that. But long-term, Jane Goodall style, I'm totally for. Unfortunately, I can't afford to do that. But I do it as much as I can, and many, many others are doing the same thing.
I'm pretty sure that Bill Gates listens to Monster X Radio. So, Bill, I know you're kind of a closet Bigfooter, and if you're wanting to sponsor a long-term Monster X Bigfoot investigation out in the field, we're happy to accommodate you. You can come along.
Oblige you.
We're obliged. We'll bring Sasquatch coffee. Come stop by, third Sunday in Portland, Oregon, and join us at Hopsquatch.
And Mr. Gates, if it sweetens the deal, I will be a part of that too.
You will get to see Guy twerk out in the field. So
get his money
that is scary. I mean, that's get your money's worth. So we're only looking for like $1 billion, I think, to get us started. But in all seriousness, I mean, there's a challenge, and there's value in doing field work, field work daytime and night. And obviously, there's, like you say, I mean,
it's the whole picture. It's the whole picture.
Yeah,
it can't be just done at day, and it can't be just done at night. It's the whole picture. It needs to be done 24/7. And some of us are doing that as much as we possibly humanly can. Long-term, and by long-term, I mean weeks, months, on end, it's very difficult. But that's what it takes. I fully believe that's exactly what it will take. Most of us are trying the best we can with what we got. It comes down to that. We are on the fringe.
Go ahead, Guy.
I think it's important. Definitely the best research we can do happens to be the most expensive. And I'm just meaning expensive as far as money, but time is very expensive too. And for someone to spend that much time away from their family, away from their job, is pretty hard to convince anybody to do. That's a huge commitment. And so
right.
I think we just have to plan on a way to make that happen. And
we're gonna see some of that with the everybody's got their opinion about the Falcon Bride, but they found a group of people that have committed to being out in the field concentrating on Bigfoot research
yeah,
for
true.
6 months. So whether
yeah.
or not, we'll see what comes out of it. I mean, there may be, best case scenario, they prove it conclusively. Worst case scenario, that's a great opportunity to see what this kind of activity for that length of time and that commitment to, will yield. So I know they're
right.
going to be doing stuff in the day and at nighttime. So,
totally agree.
It'll be interesting to see. So I'm supportive of the idea of the Falcon project, and however long it took to get it done, every idea, I got a bazillion great ideas but they all take time to come to fruition, and planning and the financing and all that stuff. So we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting. Experiment and experience. So I know that I'm going to take a shift or two of being a runner, taking supplies out, several of our team members for the Filma group, because our friend Cindy Fidel is actually the coordinator for the runners for the Falcon Project. So it'll be interesting to see what happens if anything comes out of it. So.
So have they made public which areas they're going to investigate or work?
They are not making public what areas they're going to investigate, with good reason, obviously, that, not a good, I think it's been stated that it's somewhere in Washington State. So
yes.
Where, obviously I would not go tell people, we're very careful not to tell people specifically where the Tillamook group goes and does the research, because when I got involved and we kind of gelled, that's one of the things that I insisted on, is like, we need to be very careful about not making this public knowledge, because to reduce the opportunity for people to hoax us. And that was, and
right.
that wasn't to, not to, it wasn't to exclude people that we thought would like to come up there. And, we still take people, our friends, Guy, we've talked about you coming out.
Which I still love to do, yeah.
Yeah,
it makes sense. I mean, these scientific peer-reviewed articles, usually by the time they button up the actual publication, the research, this is all after the fact of, once they've done their due diligence research and all that stuff. And so, it makes sense that, after you've worked the area for as long as you can and done all that, then you kind of provide people with the public information. You tell people that you're going someplace this weekend. It'd be very easy for everybody to rent a Bigfoot costume.
Right. Here's the GPS coordinates of where we'll be. Yeah, probably not such a good idea, but so it'll be like I said. Worst case scenario, they get skunked, but I highly doubt that if they are in a squatchy area for 6 months, and with the level of experience of some of those people, there's some great Bigfooters that are part of that group. I don't know everybody, that's doing it, but I know some of the people that are involved, and they're an asset to Bigfooting, and if there's something out there, something's going to happen. They'll come back with something, I suspect. So,
well, that, and many of the people involved are very skeptical by nature. They're not just full on everything's Bigfoot, and that's where I hold my hope for, is that if something does happen, it'll be documented correctly by every means necessary with those individuals that I do know that are going out there, that I have a lot of trust in and whatnot, had correspondence and been out in the field with. So I'm really looking forward to that aspect of it, let alone, if the blimp ever gets off the ground or not. The ground crew, to me, could be the bigger piece of the puzzle for the amount of time they're spending out there. And that's key. I'm a bit jealous because I'd love to be out there that for that extent of time, and I can only imagine the possibilities for doing such an endeavor, you know. But you know, I got to pay the bills, and you got to tend to the family and everything else.
Damn it, that's right. That was my best Larry imitation. But the idea out there is just, I mean, it's cool. The idea, and then they have a process for handling the evidence, not to turn this into the Falcon Project show, because we've done those already. But,
right.
I am excited. It's funny because Bigfooters get together and we start talking about, you know, different stuff that's going on. It's funny when Shane and I get on the phone and we're, hey, let's talk about the show and setting up. I was like, we talked for an hour and a half and we'll call back later and talk about getting the show scheduled because we're talking about Bigfoot.
Indeed.
And the way that the way that Shane approaches Bigfooting is to try different things and not just go do the same thing all the time and test theories and hypotheses.
I have the benefit. I have the benefit of looking at what's been tried before and who's tried it before and how they've tried it. So I have the benefit of being new to trying different things, looking outside the box, because I can look at some of the forefathers or some of the people that have been doing this for so long. I have that benefit. I look at the history and go, okay, well, let me take this and tweak it a little bit, or let me try this out in the field. And there's other people doing this. I'm by no means, somebody new trying this, but it really comes down to these areas that we work in that we really believe there's activity going on in, and then trying and tweaking and doing different little things that have not been tried before, or trying them in a different way. And that is truly key to me, is doing those types of things and seeing what you get out of them and not being stale. You know, if you're not getting results, it's, you know, I do a lot of fishing. You know, if you're out on a river fishing, you're not getting anything within, you know, that area that you're fishing, you move on and you fish a different area, or you try a different technique, maybe a different depth, a different type of lure. It's very much the same. You're always constantly trying to mix it up and learn from that and document exactly what you're doing and how you're doing it and learn from that. And that's why I'm so thankful for those that I'm walking on the shoulders of that have been doing this for a long time. How much I can learn from them, and it's a learning curve for me personally, but I do believe that a lot of us are doing things differently, but yet the same, but trying to learn from our past mistakes or past research that has, you know, brought something positive from.
Right, and that's and to circle back around to the guest at Hopsquatch this week, I mean, the guy, he was the glue that, you know, that kind of held the four horsemen of Bigfooting together and the great archivist. So we now have, you know, without him, where would that information and that database of stuff go on? It's like Ray Crow that had the Western Bigfoot Society and held these cool meetings for a long time that kind of was a similar guy has taken that Ray's idea of having monthly Bigfoot meetings and expanded on and made into something super cool for this generation of Bigfooters. I mean,
exactly.
And then he gets us. Hold on, I'm in Portland, right? And I don't know how many cities actually have pedal brew carts. They actually drive. It's a big cart where a bunch of people pedal this thing from bar to bar. So I'm pretty sure by the end there that pedal cart is going to be swerving back and forth, but it just went by and they're playing loud music. So excuse me for that. Well, Mr. Guy Edwards, you're the host with the most, buddy, and keep doing what you're doing, bringing programs. We're going to work with Guy to put together a super cool, apparently epic town hall for Hopwatch in for the June Hop Squad. So if you can make it, you know, whatever you got to do, take a boat, take a plane, you know, take a train, airship. If you got an air, if you happen to have an airship handy, jump on that thing and fly it up to the Lucky Lab on Quincy.
And then load it to the Falcon Project so they can actually get some cameras in the air too.
There you go. Well, maybe they'll have it by then. You never know, you know. But,
we can actually live from the Falcon Project blimp Hop Squatch.
That's right. Sponsored by.
Yeah.
Well,
that's right. Okay. Right.
I think, you know, and I really appreciate, you know, the kind words that you guys say and the support that you guys do for Hopsquatch. I don't know how many Bigfooters get to go to these, you know, annual conventions. And even though I think they're great, you spend, you know, a couple nights in a hotel room and get about two to three days of different presenters. But having something like this every month is kind of nice, too, because I think you get tons of information for a couple hours without having to travel very far or get a hotel room, and I try to bring the best of the best as far as, you know, speakers.
No, to not give you a big head and keep slapping you on the back. Yes, you're great. I know you'd rather we slap you on the butt, but good job, good game. That's the running joke is slap somebody on the butt. It's a good game, but. You do. I have created a really cool event for all Bigfooters of all different stations of Bigfooting and.
Well, it's the involvement.
I just look forward,
you know.
Yeah.
The involvement, you know, it's one of these really hands-on events where the participants, the crowd gets to talk to the guest speaking and whatnot, gets to interact, and it's just very one-on-one. You know, it's like the coolest classroom you can imagine when you're there. And I always am, you know, like I am this time around, where I didn't make this particular one. I try to make most of them. I'm really bummed because I know of the involvement and interaction. A lot of the member participants that show up, you know, are new. A lot of them are regulars, but you get this interaction and you get to find out what's going on in certain areas and stuff. It's just a really, really spectacular event. It's just, it's nothing like it, you know, and it's just that awesome.
This episode of Monster X Radio brought to you by Hopsquatch. Hopsquatch, have you been there lately?
That's Hopsquatch with two S's, HOPSSQUATCH.com.
Right, and if people want to check out, but in seriousness, if people want to check out upcoming Hopsquatches, there is a website, and Guy does post the stuff, what the upcoming program is. So it's www.hopsquatch.com, and I did that in my mind without seeing on a piece of paper. So
congratulations.
The Bigfoot Lunch Club.
Thank you. Yay.
The Bigfoot Lunch Club is a smorgasbord. It's a smorgasbord of food. So, yeah.
A Bigfoot brain food. So,
yeah.
And Guy's always posting cool stuff in there, too. That's Bigfoot Lunch Club, which...
Bigfoot Lunch Club.
Guy is...
Oh, Guy, we're about out of time.
We are. So it's... appreciate you coming and joining us, Guy. I know you had to
thank you for the invite.
Across the city,
it.
like a superhero, and jump on with us. So, what's up on next month at Hopsquatch?
So we're gonna have Joe Bilard. Joe Bilard has a big that's actually available. So if you can't make it to Portland, where he can sign it personally, it's called the Oregon Bigfoot Highway. It is a superb book. It's not like any other Bigfoot. It's actually got a dual purpose. It's actually got a little bit of a tourism aspect to it. But there's a Bigfoot, Oregon Historic Highway number 5, I believe, is all along in Clackamas, in Clackamas mm-hmm. County, which has the biggest amount of sightings per capita than any other county in the nation. And Joe Bilard has all these great stories traveling north to south on this highway of stories that we don't know about. They're not published on the internet. These are his personal notes. And he is one of those Bigfooters that actually did actually did a great job chronicling everything that he researched, everybody he interviewed, every witness that he ever talked to. He actually has all these great notes. I've been waiting for this book for about 3 years since he first talked about it. I actually got the audio version because I actually drove down the highway with Joe Bilhart. I promise you, if you are able to make it to Portland and you can get your hands on this book, it's called The Oregon Bigfoot Highway. It is a great book. It's definitely one of my favorites in my collection right now.
Fantastic.
Well, thanks so much. Thanks so much for coming and joining us, Guy. And Shane, thanks for coming. I'm sorry you couldn't make it to Hopsquatch, but you can always see the video version that's to be available.
Looking forward to it.
Sometime online. So, everybody, thanks again for listening to Monster X Radio. This is Gunner, along with Shane and our friend Guy Edwards, and we are out of here. Keep it squatchy.